car enthusiasts and the people who love them.
Hello and welcome back. This is The Thing About Cars, recording as always in Strongbox West on the west side of Atlanta. We've got some really cool folks around the table today. We have
Ben
and
Becca
and
Leanne.
You're very new to this group. Can you? Where did we meet you?
Oh, at the Brookhaven Art Rolling Art Show.
Yeah, and we talked briefly about your. Am I allowed to call it a Roadster?
It is.
Yeah.
It's a 1929 Ford Roadster, mm-hmm. but it's a 29 chassis on deuce rails with a 53 Merc.
How fast does it go?
It boogies, but you don't want to get it too fat because the brake bias is a little interesting, so you don't want to go in hot.
It gets
light in a hurry, says the voice of experience.
She's absolutely gorgeous, though.
Thank you.
She or he?
She.
Ah, okay. Oh, that's right, because you have the...
I also have Miss Buttercup. So the Gal's Garage.
I love it.
Yeah.
What is Miss Buttercup?
Miss Buttercup is a 1936 Ford Roadster, so she's got the big yellow fenders and the rumble seat and the big headlights and the
nice.
Greyhound hood ornament. And
nice.
So she's a beauty and a wonderful little and kind of horns.
Right.
Which everybody loves. So.
Well, I hope we get to see her someday.
Mm.
You didn't sell the black one yet, did you?
Have not sold the black one yet. And then we're getting ready to modernize the transmission in Miss Buttercup. She's currently her original 3-speed, but the 29 has a fifth gear override, which is lovely when you do the V8 engine, gives you a little more RPM, a little more chutzpah. So to make Miss Buttercup a little more bulletproof, so we can take her touring, we're going to modernize that transmission.
Cool.
Dynamite.
So when you say modernize, is she an automatic, first of all?
No, she's a manual.
She's a manual, okay.
But she's a 3-speed, but the drive shaft that keeps breaking is a 1936 drive shaft.
Yeah.
Finding an original drive shaft for a 1936 car is, you can do it, but again, you're putting old parts in theory on an old problem. So
right.
Know, and when you want to go down the road and not have to take the ride of shame home on a flatbed,
mm-hmm.
you want to make her a little more bulletproof. So and that way she's fun. I mean, more people, if they did that to more old cars, I think people would enjoy them more because the big thing about taking an old car down the road is if you're not a mechanic or can't work in it, you don't have a riding mechanic and you don't know where the flat truck is,
right. You
don't really want to tour with it. But if you modernized it but keep the look of the vintage, mm-hmm. like we're not doing, you know, it still has that good V8 look to it, you know, then it's fun.
And that's something that I've talked about, just making something look how it used to be, but the guts of it are newer or different. Not to be confused with an LS swap. Just saying. Just putting that out there.
Becca has a...
issue.
An issue. A prejudicial issue with LS swaps. She thinks they're overrated and doesn't really respect them too much.
No, I think that's not quite accurate. Because remember, I also own an LS. But then we also have to remember the status of the LS. So no, and I don't want to stray off topic. I want to hear more about... what she has to say, but...
Well, you're right. I mean, we had a hot rod shop in Indianapolis for a while, and we'd have a client come in, and he wanted us to restore his 1940 Ford that his father had, and he wanted to store it, you know, OEM, original specs, everything original, because that's the way his dad would have wanted it.
Mm-hmm.
So we finished this beautiful restoration. We send it back up to him, and 2 weeks later, we get a phone call that says, it leaks. Yes, 1940 Ford's leaked. They have little gasket issues. They have little drips and drops. You didn't want it modernized underneath, or like a Shelby Cobra had no bump steer in it.
Mm-hmm.
So when you redo it, do you put it so that it's a fun convertible to drive, or do you make it like Carol made it, which was a race car and is a little bit rough around the corner? So these are good questions.
We've talked about this before, but you have an impressive resume in the world of automotive fun and entertainment and industry in general.
I make a lot of grown men cry.
Yeah.
And I love that alone.
Right. For many reasons.
No.
can you make some grown men cry on our podcast?
I have had the great, to be honest with you, great pleasure of being around some of the greatest drivers in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I did work for Carroll Shelby.
Mm-hmm.
I was the series director for the Dodge Shelby Pro Series and enjoyed, you know, working with Carroll. He's a piece of work.
Yes, he is.
He's a hoot.
I dated one of his granddaughters for a couple of years, so yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
You hear him before you actually see him from the window.
Oh, yeah.
Best way to be. And everybody probably knows how I feel about Carroll Shelby at this point. So, never got to meet him, but...
Becca is seriously into Mustangs.
To say the least.
To say the least. That's something of an understatement, but yes.
Yes.
Yeah. But, so, what else? I mean, there's plenty.
But I started my career in motorsports, which has been a 30-year career in racing, at what is now Sonoma Racing, what back then was Sears Point Racing, back in 1989. In fact, we're going on that 30-year anniversary of my first job in racing. So I was the promotions director at Sears Point Raceway, and my very first job was to introduce NASCAR Winston Cup to the San Francisco Bay Area.
Right.
Mm-hmm. I had never seen a race before.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. You know, that's special.
Right. So did you just land into this job then? You weren't seeking it out?
I really wasn't. I had been working at 96 Rock, so a lot of Atlantans will know 96
Rock. I know
Rock.
96 Rock.
And I was the continuity chick, so all the commercial stuff. But I had gotten to know... and fallen in love with promotions and done a lot of work with the promotions director there, Mark Cooper, who's just fabulous.
Mark Cooper, yep.
He's awesome. And so learned a lot from him, really wanted to be a promotions director, and the first job offering came in California. I was 25, single. It was California. It could have been pink poodle farming, and I would have gone.
Yeah.
It just happened to be, you know, a racetrack. And but I had grown up in the events business, actually in the Southern Bicycle League. My family's one of the first families of the Southern Bicycle League. So had done a lot of bicycling and event type of things. So that's how I got out there. But it was interesting because, again, I had never been to the track. Mm-hmm. And so there was a guy named Bob Weeks. And Bob Weeks worked for Bill France Sr. starting back in the 50s. Mm-hmm. And he had an amazing story. And so he gave me a tour through the garages and down into the pits. And he said, look, he gave me all these great stories about Smokey Yunick and Richard Petty. And he said, look, these stories, your accent, you're going to be just fine. and then the next day, we were at a media luncheon, and a driver came up. But I didn't know it was a driver. It was back in the days where you had polos with no logos. This is before embroidery. I am not that old. It's really, we haven't been around that long with embroidery. And this guy came up, and he just looked a little lost. And I'm like, well, can I help you? You know, he's like, oh, I'm Michael Waltrip. I'm like, oh, that's nice. I'm Leanne. Do you need some help? He goes, no, I'm a driver. I'm like, oh, great. Do you need anything?
Nice.
You know. And so Saturday comes. I have to give garage tours. I have 75 people following me around with hot pink Hawaiian punch hats. And you're guiding your sheep through. And we come through the haulers. And I'm who walks out of the hauler. But ladies and gentlemen, this is driver Michael Waltrip, who looks at me like, you were so full of it. But he comes over and gives me this massive bear hug. I'm like, ah, credibility. And that's how I kind of got started in NASCAR. And at Sears Point. But at Sears Point, it was baptism by fire because we ran NASCAR, AMA, Trans Am, IMSA. We had Good Guys car shows, which was a brand new thing back then. So it was really a baptism by fire. So it was about 2 years doing that.
And very cool.
Then a little time with Carol. And then I actually started, I fell in love with a guy, and we went to IndyCar, and we went to Indy, and he had a history in IndyCar. So when the split happened between IRL and CART, we chose that opportunity to start a small IndyCar team. Mm. So we ran on the full IndyCar series as team owner, team managers for about 8 years.
Amazing.
And then spent a lot of time in the open wheel space in running Indy Lights programs, Pro Mazda programs, built the Sham Schmidt Motorsports program, the Bilardi Auto Racing program are two of my things that are still running today. So it was a good ride. It's a really good ride.
Dynamite.
But you're saying was a good ride. Does that mean you're done? Or
you never say never.
Yeah.
Never say never. But I have moved back here to Atlanta. This is home for me. And so I've taken a little break. But there's always some conversation flowing. So we'll see what happens next.
Yeah. Cool.
Yeah.
Very good. It's always the people that lock into the dream jobs for the rest of us that are just drooling over something.
Well, I don't know.
Well, she wasn't aiming to be in the cars, and it just...
No, but I can say that when I got there, there were people there that, I guess when I first showed up with the interview, white pants, red heels, you know, it was summer. The lady thought, oh, geez, what's walking in the door? But afterwards, Rhea told me, she says, you look more track savvy than most people. So I, you know, I earned my right to stay there. And I've really had the opportunity to work with some gals that were really the ones that opened up the path for me there. Mm-hmm. Because remember, well, you may not remember, you look rather young.
Well, thank you.
In 1989, women had only been allowed in the NASCAR garage area for like 7 years. Mm-hmm. So, and IndyCar and NASCAR had both, you know, banned women before women. That's the era that they, a lot of these gals started in. So they didn't get into the garage area until the late 70s, early 80s. And so many of the women that I had the pleasure of working with were truly the first gals to go into the garage area and make it possible.
Mm-hmm.
But right. when I was working in the garage area very early on, I was like one of eight women actually getting a paycheck in the garage. So, you know, we were kind of rare.
Right.
But it was really an amazing experience to have that opportunity.
Right. It just sounds amazing. I'm jealous.
Well, but at the same time, you don't really appreciate kind of where that comes from. I mean, there were women there that usually media is the entry to industry. You know, we're all thankful to Barbara Walters. Well, no matter what you think of your, without Barbara Walters, we would have missed a lot of things.
Right.
So the media gals come in. It was a lawsuit at the Indianapolis Motor Speedway that first opened up those doors. A media girl sued for the right. She was a hippie chick. And they were like, so what would you ask the drivers if you were actually in the garage area? You know, there was a lot of that kind of criticism. But Tony Holman finally made the decision to allow her in.
Mm.
And the very first year, he allowed any formally credentialed member of the female media that could come in. That's who could got to come in first. And I once asked his secretary at the time, I'm like, so what was the hesitation about bringing gals in? Because, you know, what, big chauvinist? The answer was no, he really wasn't. He was afraid that the minute the girls came in, the garage would be a party. And that the guys would make mistakes. Because understand that on an Indy car, there's 2,000 parts.
Mm-hmm.
So if you're 99% right, you still got 20 parts that could go wrong.
Right.
And into turn one at 230 miles an hour, a 75-cent part in the wrong spot that breaks kills you.
Yeah.
So a guy making a mistake on a car because there's cute chicks sitting there is actually a real problem. Mind you, a cute guy running around the garage area being a bonehead is an equal problem. And there were plenty of those guys there, too. But, you know, that's really why the insurance policy came in place. You have to cover your shoulders. You have to, you know, that's because the girls came in scantily clad. But that was actually his reasoning for not letting girls in. But anyway, he acquiesced. And the very first IndyCar mechanic came in, and that was Anita Milliken. She was the very first woman to go over the wall. First IndyCar mechanic, had been one for 40 years. And she went over the wall formally for 2 years on the machinist union car.
Mm-hmm.
That was, and she was the jack man.
Jack person.
The jack man. And nobody knew it because she wore a balaclava. So she was like in secret stuff. But, you know, that's at a time when they're coming in hot and it's real fuel and there's fires. And she's in control of the entire pit stop because those drivers were trained, you know, to go as soon as that car hits the pavement. And so she has to make sure everybody's done, what the traffic is coming down the pits, do it on a split second, you know, and release that guy. But she used to tell her drivers, you come in completely screwed up and hot and sliding all over the place, uh-uh. You know, make it happen.
So you've seen a ton of change within the industry.
I have.
It's just amazing.
I have. The very first year we were at Indy, which was 1996. Some people might remember a little thing called Windows got launched in the fall of 1995.
Mm-hmm.
Windows. And so my very first Windows lesson was actually in the Indianapolis Motor Speedway warming up our engines because that was the first time we had ever had to use computer technology to warm up our engines.
No kidding.
Uh-huh. Yeah. I mean, so 1996, people were thinking, wow, I remember I wasn't that old. See, we're not that old.
Right.
But that was pretty rare.
Yeah.
And I was our first data gal because I was the only one that, you know, had a laptop and even knew what to do with it. But that was the first time we did that. So even engineering in the sport really got introduced in the early 80s. Shock technology is all early 80s stuff. Anita Milliken, the same gal I spoke of, she and her husband Howard invented the shock dyno. They were the first to put an Indy car on a flow bench. All of that engineering started actually in those early 80 periods, which up until then, it was all mechanical knowledge.
Right.
You know, there's a difference between, you know, aero grip and mechanical grip.
Yep.
Most people don't know that you have both of those. And so up until that point, it was all mechanical. And then the engineering started to come along. And then there's some people who will tell you, oh, that's what ruined motorsports forever because it all went to a computer at that point. But, you know, but that takes it away from the guys that really enjoyed really working on the nuances of, like, let's redesign the headers. Well, the minute Honda came into IndyCar, small teams got, you didn't work on your headers anymore. They told you what headers to run. They tell you what gear to run. They tell you how long you're going to warm your engine up. It took a lot of the creativity out of a team. Yeah.
So the computers didn't ruin the sport. It sounds like bureaucracy ruined the sport.
Well, the fact that engineering came in and allowed some of that to take over. I mean, I remember one team, I guess they should go nameless at this point, they brought in five engineers, and they had a shock engineer and a ride height engineer and an engine engineer and a, you know, they had all these different engineers, and the problem comes when they don't talk to each other.
Yeah.
Right.
Because they're all separate, and there's not kind of one, you know, head engineering. Or we started getting into periods where the kids coming up through the ranks, the Mazda Road to Indy series, which is now just Road to Indy because Mazda just left, they wanted to make sure that they had a data guy. And so they would come in after a session, and they would show them all this telemetry. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to, and the telemetry would tell them if they were missing a tenth in this corner and a half a tenth here, or where the perfect left was. But now you have a kid that may not be gifted, but pretty good.
Yeah.
And he's now trying to memorize the fact that in turn five, he's got a break 2 feet later. And he's trying to put this whole corner together. And the engineers are then worried about what's upsetting the car. And that's backwards. The fact is there's no such thing as a hot setup. If your driver's not comfortable, he will be pokey.
So we're talking about cars now in ways that most people are not used to talking about cars.
Yeah, probably so.
Well, and I want to go back to something that was said a minute ago as far as the, if the technology ruined it, and I'm not at all saying that technology has ruined it in any way. But yeah, just either driving or working on a car, feeling it, feeling if you are, you know, running rich or lean, or feeling how the car is responding, or even just the smell of what's coming out of the car, the art form of it, as opposed to reading a screen that says, oh, you're right where you should be, or so I kind of understand that, and I'm not jabbing at the technology. I know there's a place for
it. There's all a place for it. It's all a good thing, but.
But, well, and I haven't quite convinced them. I want to rip out what I have, not because I want to get rid of technology. I just want to have what I built in it.
Right. Well, and you're not up for grabs with, you know, millions and millions of dollars of race money. You
know? No.
Yeah.
No.
He's also not A.J. Foyt, who got so mad at his laptop he threw it in the grandstands.
Very nice.
True That's story.
I believe it. I do believe it.
They ran out of fuel on the track. Ah, boom, into the grandstands it went.
Too funny.
But ultimately, that's what it all boils down to. You're trying to win to make money, right?
Well,
no.
You're not?
No.
Some people.
No.
It's not about increasing the value of your sponsorship dollars?
That's a different thing than the paycheck.
The
purse will never, ever cover what you spend in racing.
No.
If you're going to make $1 million in racing, you're going to start with two. That's all there is to it. So it's not about the money. It's about the win. It's about the trophy. It's about the I beat you. It's about the competition.
Maybe we're talking owner over driver.
No,
or...
well, an owner's that way too. But then there's the one marketing geek on the side that says, can I get some impressions here?
Right.
Because that's where my sponsorship comes from. But at the very core of the race team, this is about racing. This is not about a sponsorship dollar.
Surely these guys are not going broke in the process of trying to become winners, are they?
Some guys.
There are, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
The fact is that to a certain level, you look, they're the Penske's of the world that have done very, very well. They're the Hendricks who have these wonderful stories of, once upon a time, setting out to be a tire distributor and building it up to a NASCAR, you know, Hall of Famer that he is.
Right.
But then there's those small teams. Look, 95% of racing are sportsmen. 95% of racing are the 85,000 sportsmen drag racers. They're the 50,000 SECA sportsmen national class racers. They're the, I think there's probably 75,000 guys running around dirt tracks, running late models. You know, they're the sprint car guys. Those guys, they're not making any money off of this.
See, those are most of the people that I know, the people racing at Dixie Speedway or
That's
the people
it.
Drag racing down at Silver Dollar. Those are the people that I know, and they're not making it big. And, yeah, they are bankrupting, but it's...
They're mortgaging their homes. They are the guts of this business. They're trying to make sure... Gosh, can I get more laps on that last set of tires? If I can just squeeze out another 10 laps or another session, that's the heart of the sport. So what you see up at the pinnacle of it, the top 5%, is a completely different animal from what you see in the guts of the sport.
Mm-hmm. Amazing. Mm-hmm. Just amazing. I mean, it kind of blows my mind. I mean, on the one hand, yes, I appreciate what you're saying about pure sportsmanship and just getting out there to race and win. On the other hand, don't mortgage your whole freaking house and lose everything over this.
Yes,
right?
But I could win the Winston 400 this time. I know I can.
It's the passion that takes over to near obsession.
Yeah, the Snowball Derby's everything, because if I win that, then I might get a sponsor. See, dude? Mm-hmm. You're missing the point.
All I got to do is this. Yes.
That's right.
Yes. And by the way, just a shameless plug for a very old movie for whatever giggles. Six Pack with Kenny Rogers.
Oh,
do you know the one I'm talking about? There are a lot of cuss words, so don't bring your children.
Not for kids.
A lot of it was actually filmed here in
yes.
Atlanta.
Oh yeah.
But he's a dirt track racer, basically. So.
All right. Well, let's wrap up this episode. There's plenty more to talk about. I want to ask Leanne a couple of important questions, but let's take this one out. Business as usual, please find us on Facebook at facebook.com/thethingaboutcars. Our website is thethingaboutcars.com. We do have a Patreon. I hope you'll find us there and support our efforts to bring a better show to you. What else am I forgetting, you guys?
I think you got it.
Excellent. Great.
I think so.
So, as always, this is The Thing About Cars at Strong Box West. Wishing you guys an excellent week and be safe out there.
Bye.
See ya.
Thank you for listening. This has been The Thing About Cars. We'll see you on the road.